This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Despite all the green hype, carbon emissions are rising and the increase is increasing. Face the facts, this is a human problem requiring human solutions, and if you don't like the idea of new taxes on carbon, our next guest says we are already paying plenty for climate change. As an experienced journalist, Mark Shapiro tackles the whole messy climate problem. His new book is Carbon Shock, A Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of the Disrupted Global Economy. And it sure is disrupted. Shapiro has appeared everywhere that intelligent reporting is allowed, like PBS specials and features in magazines like Harper's and the Atlantic Monthly. As an award-winning environmental journalist, one of his previous books was Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products. You're going to hear a lot about carbon shock this fall, so let's get in early on Radio EcoShock. Mark Shapiro, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, you say we're already paying a price for carbon. It's just that it's hidden. Can you explain that a little?
Yeah, I think that's the interesting way to begin to understand, actually, the choices that we face in moving forward, because often the dynamic is framed in such a way that we're going to have to pay X amount of money in order to invest in renewable technology and such, and that is going to be expensive. And number one, that is true. It's going to cost some level of investment in a green infrastructure to wean us away from fossil fuels. I think much less expensive than we think, but still it's going to cost something. So then it becomes this question. What are we already paying? And actually, when you look deeply at a whole array of phenomenon across the board in terms of the public expenditure today, when you look at the expenses for everything starting with like public health and the increase of public health costs as kind of formerly tropical diseases move into the United States, which is happening. When you look into the rising cost for sustaining the infrastructure across the United States to protect our coastlines, when you look across the board at the different challenges, when you look at the rising food costs and the challenge that farmers are facing, you know what one of the most expensive expenditures is for the United States government, now one of the most dramatically rising expenses, is crop insurance. Crop insurance is supported by the U.S. government here in the United States. And the areas most related to climate change when it comes to heat, when it comes to extreme weather, are the ones that have been rising most significantly in the crop insurance system. So my point is really to begin to make an honest assessment of what these expenditures are to understand we are already spending hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to deal with the impact of climate change. So first step, and this is what I write about in my book, is understanding what those costs are. Those costs have largely been hidden by an accounting system, which actually doesn't call them costs. When we purchase fossil fuels, when we purchase gasoline, when we purchase other forms of fossil fuels, the price that we're paying does not reflect those costs that we ultimately end up paying as members of society and as tax-paying parts of both the United States and Canada and every other country that's impacted.
Well, right. Lately, the TV news has a new feature I call weather porn. We watch city after city flooding out due to extreme rainfall events. And the general line is the victimized area got a month or more of rain in 24 hours. And it's just peculiar weather, you know, nothing to do with climate change, of course. And the drainage systems from a previous century can't cope with it. That means big spending for cities that are already broke. Is that a symptom of what you're writing about?
Well, yes, that is exactly the symptom. You put it very well, that in a way, as individuals living in wherever we might be, in this country, in Europe, in Africa, any continent on Earth, essentially, we experience the weather as individuals. You know, a huge rainstorm comes and we're like, oh my God, the streets are flooding, or it gets incredibly hot and we're suddenly subject to, you know, 90, 100 degree temperatures, you know, Fahrenheit, that are sweltering. And we experience those as individual moments of an extreme. What you need to begin doing is to actually start seeing across the board, when you see those phenomena in every corner of the earth, basically these extremes of temperature altering the conditions of life down here on earth, that's how we begin to understand what the impacts of climate change are. And so those kind of freak rainstorms that you're talking about are essentially not so freaky anymore. And I think that's what the climate science is telling us, is these events that used to be extreme, that used to happen in only under extraordinary circumstances once every 50 or 100 years, are now more and more the norm.
And we're seeing headlines saying the California drought is going to push up food prices, and they're already pretty high, I think. Do we have any indications or science that this California drought is related to climate change rather than being a cycle that appears every now and then?
Well, that's actually a very good question. And the science is very clear. And there are numerous scientific reports, which I cite in my book, all starting at the United Nations team of global scientists all the way down to some of the most respected scholarly journals in the world, essentially are talking about this phenomenon converging for a number of different reasons. In fact, what's interesting when it comes to the California drought, there's not necessarily less objective water falling, right? In some cases, there are less objective numbers of water, but the biggest concern for the state is that because the atmosphere is warming, what used to fall as snow in the winter time, right? So we're talking now about the months of, let's say, December to February. When it gets pretty cold, it's supposed to get pretty cold up in the mountains in California. Well, the snow would fall during the winter month and create essentially a solid reservoir of water. And later in the year, starting in, let's say, March to, you know, June, when the temperature starts heating up, that snow would melt. And as it melted, replenish basically the parts of the state that were very dry, right? So basically you have a whole channeling system to take that water when it starts to melt and bring it down to the southern parts of the state that are far more dry than the northern parts of the state. Well, what's happening now is that actually instead of snow falling in those winter months, what's happening is rain is falling. And less quantities of rain, but still rain does fall between those months of November and February. And the water system of California is not designed to use that massive quantity of water that's suddenly coming from the mountains, not as snow and sitting there, but it's actually running into the state water system. And that water system was designed essentially to handle water as it came kind of incrementally down from the mountains. Now it's being overwhelmed. And so you have a massive amount of water that's actually being, quote, wasted in the sense of it's not being channeled properly to agriculture or to the southern cities because it's overwhelming the reservoir system. And that's one part of the phenomenon that is very clearly linked to climate change. And there's another aspect which I'd like to point out. I spent a lot of time in reporting this book in the Central Valley of California, which is one of the breadbaskets of the United States. I mean, they grow more fruits, vegetables, nuts than any other part of this country. Stress is appearing all over the place, and we're talking about in large farms. You know, these are big, big farms. And you see, for example, I learned a lot in doing this book. Let me tell you, I learned a lot about agriculture. And one thing I learned was that when it comes to very sensitive tree crops, most vividly with cherries, and I'm sure all of us, you have enjoyed a nice juicy red cherry in the springtime. And California has long been one of the leading cherry producers in the United States, along with Washington and Oregon. Well, what has happened is that cherries, guess what? Cherries need, in the month of December, January, basically, in order to fully ripen, cherries need to get cold. They need to actually have a period of time, which they call chill hours, in which it gets very, very chilly, which enables the cherry to essentially hibernate. That's the wrong technical word, to essentially slow down its metabolic forces so that when it comes up in those beautiful, resplendent harvest season in the spring with all those beautiful buds and flowers and juicy red cherries, part of that comes because it's been able to reserve its own internal resources during that chill period in December, January. Well, that chill period, when it gets cold, when it's supposed to get cold, has been shrinking dramatically. And so what you found is a roughly 20% decline in the number of hours that are cold enough to enable the cherries to go into that chill period, which has meant that the cherries that are coming out in parts of the Central Valley in California, particularly in the San Joaquin Valley, are ending up smaller and stunted, and the trees are not delivering as much yield as they used to. And that, too, is a phenomenon of climate change. And this is backed up by numerous studies out of Stanford, different universities, they're all footnoted in my book. My book has extensive scientific footnotes to back up all these kind of ideas. I mean, this comes from the science. And what I try to do in my book was take the science. I read those scientific journals. I tried to understand what they were arguing. And then I went out into the fields, into the places where those phenomena that are being described by scientists are actually being experienced by people. And you really feel that most vividly when it comes to the sort of situation of farmers. And they'll all tell you that the weather is unlike any they've ever seen over the last 5 to 10 years.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is respected journalist Mark Shapiro, formerly a senior correspondent for the Center for Investigative Reporting and a teacher at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. We're visiting Mark's new book, Carbon Shock. There's several dodges that you go into the book. We can't really do much more here than list them due to time limitations, but you talk about embedded emissions into consumer products and about the whole aviation industry game. Talk to us about the airplanes. We pay more taxes to drive to work than we do to fly across the country?
Yes, that's really something I learned in the process of doing this book. When it comes to airplanes, you know, let's remember, airplanes use massive quantities of fuel. And one of the big issues now in the debate in the world is essentially how to account for the greenhouse gases that come out of the back of those airplanes, which actually even have more damage to the atmosphere because they're actually emitted in the atmosphere. And so there's been a hidden kind of like very quiet but enormously significant battle that's been brewing between the European Union. The Europeans have passed a policy which requires that airplanes that fly in and out of Europe begin to pay a small price for the greenhouse gases that come out of the back of the airplanes. And every time you fly to Europe, whether you know it or not, the pilot is submitting a figure as to how much fuel he is using to the aviation authorities in Europe and the greenhouse gases that come from the back of that plane. The United States has not liked that idea. The United States has objected strenuously to the European approach. And there is now a sort of a battle emerging, a diplomatic row, in which the United States, along with China and Russia, this is one area we're actually aligned with Russia very closely on, as well as other large developing countries, to try to block the European effort to have us pay for our aviation emissions. What's interesting about this battle, and I describe it in length, and it's very dramatic. I mean, it's actually, most people have no idea this is happening, but there's enormous amount happening behind the scenes diplomatically, with a lot of leverage being waged, and it's being called the first kind of trade war over climate change. One of the interesting things about that is, how do you go about regulating a transnational industry like aviation? And this is where climate change gets so interesting and provocative in terms of figuring our way forward, because it challenges traditional notions of national sovereignty. How do you regulate emissions that are literally pumped into the atmosphere across numerous national frontiers in an airplane? Well, this question is now being debated and is actually going to probably be resolved in the next year or two, and it's worth keeping an eye out on. And I go into some detail on this question.
Mark Shapiro, do you think anything substantive will happen at the 2015 climate talks?
The answer to that is yes. I actually have now been pretty deeply immersed in studying the economic questions surrounding climate change. And I think we need to acknowledge, as much disappointment as people might have in terms of the speed with which change is happening, that there is an enormous amount of attention now being given to how to begin try to slow down the emissions from fossil fuels. And we've moved a long way from Copenhagen, which was in 2009 and widely perceived as, broadly speaking, a failure in terms of an international agreement. Now we have President Obama beginning to take some actions here in the United States, the Europeans moving forward, the Japanese, even the Chinese, and I write about this in my book, how the Chinese are beginning to actually take significant actions to deal with their greenhouse gas emissions. So I think 2015 is going to be a very critical year. The popular pressure from the citizens' movements, both in this country and abroad, is intensifying. There's, of course, going to be large demonstrations worldwide at the end of September, third week of September, when there's going to be a big summit at the United Nations to begin laying the groundwork for an international agreement. So I'm hopeful that actually some kind of agreement is going to happen. Whether it's fast enough, I don't know. Whether it's aggressive enough is a question, but I'm pretty hopeful that things are going to begin to start moving forward.
Well, among the less hopeful, I had a guest, Dr. Tim Garrett. He's a scientist at the University of Utah. He published a peer-reviewed paper showing carbon emissions equal wealth. And so far, he says, only societies that experience a significant collapse, like the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, have been able to reduce emissions on a scale that matters. That was 5% in their case. From your research in carbon shock, can we save ourselves without an economic collapse and a big retreat from consumer spending?
Well, that is an extremely good question. I think that, yes, the example, ironically enough, actually, the economic recession in Europe also meant, and in the United States, between 2008 to 2012, roughly, meant a decline in emissions. That is definitely not to argue for the benefits of economic recession. The question of how to get us to significant reductions, look, I think it's too easy to be apocalyptic about this. I don't think we're talking about the end of the world as we know it. I don't think we're talking about the collapse of civilization as we know it. I just want to make that clear. I'm not tending to apocalypse. I think that actually there are initiatives breaking out all over the world. Both in here in my own state of California, we have a greenhouse gas law that's beginning slowly to shift public resources towards a greener energy grid. You have similar things afoot in New England. You have had in Canada, there was a bit of a retreat in Canada. There's also been a retreat in Australia. This is a very complicated question. So when we look at guideposts for success, I think we have to keep our eye on the large picture, which is that we have to do some dramatic shifting of the way we organize the energy grids all over the world. That needs to happen urgently. The enormity of the challenge is really about shifting the basis upon which we've had economic growth for the past 200 years in a very fundamental way. Basically, I agree with the conclusion of the scientists in Utah that you cite, that thus far we've seen a significant emission declines during periods of economic recession. And that's both in Russia, the former Soviet Union. It also happens to be the case in the European Union and the United States during this period of our recession. In Russia, that was more in the early 90s. So the issue here is not to strive for an economic recession. The issue is to take the large amounts of public money that are now used to subsidize the fossil fuel industries. And we subsidize them in numerous ways. Number one, we give explicit subsidies still to the oil and gas industries. In the United States, roughly about $4 billion a year in explicit subsidies to those industries. One. Two, massive hundreds of millions of dollars in monies that we are paying for the public health consequences, the infrastructure consequences, the consequence on our food system and numerous other elements to essentially subsidize the cost of fossil fuels. And this is the economic equation that has to change. We have to basically start taking that money, which we are already using to subsidize the fossil fuel companies, and shifting that in a more green direction. And I think that that's what's essential, is that people understand the economics of this decision. If they're worried about the amount of money involved in shifting us to a more green economy, they need to begin to understand how much money they're already spending to subsidize the very industries that have gotten us into this mess.
Another recent Radio EcoShock guest from the UK, George Marshall, said he's tired of seeing the same faces at every climate talk. And if we want to survive, he says, we need to take this thing out of the San Francisco Bay Area and into Texas, or wherever the equivalent conservative carbon zone is in Canada, the UK, or Australia. Can we get conservatives on board to fix climate change?
Well, it's interesting that you should put it that way. Number one, there's a growing movement, even among kind of economic conservatives, who actually see the benefits of a carbon tax. And what's interesting about that is these are people who actually are committed to the principles of the free market. And if you are committed to the principles of the free market, to the actual free market, then and what their concern is that the existing market basically unfairly tilts the playing field toward the fossil fuel industries, because it provides these numerous subsidies and ways for paying for fossil fuels that actually create an asymmetry in the market when it comes to actually making the choice over renewables versus fossil fuels. So one, George Mason University is one place where this is happening. George Mason as a kind of a conservative kind of think tank run by former Republican congressman from South Carolina that's been pushing for a carbon tax. Even some large companies have been pushing for a large multinational companies have been pushing for a tax. Number one, because it also would create a sense of kind of a level playing field. So you don't have like one place like California that might be more extreme than Texas. And therefore, if you're a big multinational company, you don't want to deal with all these competing standards. So there's something to be said for that. At the same time, you have in literally Texas, for example, which you cite, is the leading user in this country of wind power. So of all the states in the country, of the United States, that uses wind power, relies most heavily on wind power for its electricity, that state is Texas. Obviously a very conservative state and far from the San Francisco Bay Area. And that's because of the economics of wind power. They have a lot of wind, and it definitely stacks up competitive-wise with the fossil fuels. So the point is to begin opening our eyes to where the potentials are for renewables, and they're all over the country and all over the world. I'm not sure this is any longer a question of a bunch of kind of emotional, whatever that caricature of the San Francisco Bay Area is, emotional nature lover, eco fanatics, however you want to characterize that. I think we are far, far, far beyond that caricature, because actions related to climate change are actually happening all over the world, including, by the way, in China. And I write about this in my book, that actually some of the most interesting initiatives related to climate change are happening in China, which is aggressively pursuing a kind of renewable energy development for its electrical grid, as well as exporting massive quantities of solar and wind technology. So we have to begin to look at these things differently, and I think that is a grotesque oversimplification to suggest that the primary energy on this question comes from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Well, no insult to San Francisco. I've got lots of great listeners there. Look, is there a website for this new book, Mark Shapiro, and how can people follow your work?
Yes, thank you. The book is available. It's in bookstores all over the country, I believe. It's also on your usual kind of online sales. I'm on Twitter. If you go to @Shapiro, and Shapiro, S-C-H-A-P-I-R-O, I'll be tweeting a lot. And I'll be blogging in different places, but I will kind of let you know via Twitter where those pieces will be showing up. I'll be writing a lot also in the run-up to the climate conference later in September.
This is Alex Smith saying we are in carbon shock, whether we admit it or not. Investigative journalist Mark Shapiro has laid out the facts, and he adds some excitement to the chase, I think, in his new book, Carbon Shock, A Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of the Disrupted Global Economy. It's just out from Chelsea Green Books. You can find more links in my weekly show blog, published at ecoshock.info. Mark, thanks for explaining some of the basic facts of carbon life.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.